It is the Friday Wrestling Observer Radio, and Dave, you got somewhat of a story on Dory Funk. I know it's not the one that you're waiting to write for next week, but you got a lot of words up there on Dory Funk this morning.
Yeah. I mean, I basically, what I did was I was, I wanted to do essentially his career up through the world title reign and then end it like right before he lost the world title. Mm-hmm. That was kind of like my idea for this story, because there's a lot of info that I'm still waiting to get from historians on the whole career. So I didn't really want to do the big story without it. Just because there'd be a lot of stuff lacking. And so that's what I was concentrating on. It was kind of like, his growing up and his, football, and then going to how he started his career in wrestling in his early years, and the decision on him getting the world championship and going through the world title reign. And, you know, the beginnings, I'll write a lot more about the Briscoe stuff, but you know, the St. Louis match, I wanted to write about that one, 'cause that was kind of a pivotal match in the career of Briscoe and him. And, you know, Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe were very united in the minds of people if they watched wrestling in the 1970s. I mean, it was the, you know, it was the Omega Okada, you know, Austin Rock, Flair Steamboat. Flair Steamboat's probably the best analogy of all of them. You know, it was the one, you know, it was the match they did over and over and over again, and it was considered, you know, the best match anyone had ever seen in that style. And of course, styles change. And, Dory is a lot about time and place. You know, I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, he was, you know, I mean, everybody thought, like, you know, he was the best guy in the business because he was the world champion. And that's what you were taught. But as a worker too, because he, you know, worked, I mean, he just worked so great as world champion. It was, I mean, it's funny because, like, today you would look at it, and I mean, people used to do this and just go, like, why'd they ever make him world champion? You know what I mean? And it's like, well, if you're there, you kind of understood, because I saw his matches and I saw his aura, and, you know, it was so different from, you know, Ric Flair, even Harley Race. You know, it was different from all of them. It was different from Luthez. You know, I mean, they had a mentality of what they wanted him to be, and he fit it perfectly. And he really became, very iconic in Japan. You know, he was the first one, I think, where his, you know, it's like the matches became big. You know, before it was like the stars were big, but it wasn't really the matches that were big. But with Dory, it was like, you know, the matches with Jack Briscoe and the match with, you know, the matches with Antonio Inoki in Japan and in other territories with, you know, all the different Tim Woods in Georgia and Florida and, Billy Robinson in Hawaii and Calgary and just, you know, Johnny Weaver and, you know, even Fritz Von Erich doing 60 minutes with Fritz Von Erich, which could not have been easy, at Texas Stadium in 96 degree weather. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was a master of pacing. He had great, great conditioning, great professional wrestling technical ability. And then, you know, the later the Funks in Japan, and I was at many, many, many Funk Brothers matches in Japan in 84 when they had the comeback tour after the Terry retirement. I wish I had gone earlier, you know, when we talk about famous matches, you know, the Funks against Bruiser Brody and Jimmy Snuka in the finals of that tag team tournament, 81 or 82. The Funks, the match I saw in Nagoya with the Funks against Bruiser Brody and Stan Hansen, and other matches with them, that was a really big feud. The Funks against Abdul the Butcher and the Sheik in 1977 was, again, one of the most famous matches in Japanese history. I mean, the Inoki match and the Sheik and Butcher match and the Brody and Snuka match. I mean, I remember in, so not the Inoki match, but in, When I was in Japan, I remember one of the years I was in Japan, I think this is 1990, NTV did a special, you know, like the 10 greatest matches in all Japan history. And, you know, the Funks against the 77 World Tag Team Tournament Finals, which the Funks against Sheik and Butcher, you know, was on that list. And the Funks against Brody and Snuka was on that list. And I'm trying to think if there may have been others. Those two, for sure. I know that Dory Funk Jr. and Horst Hoffman in one of the champion carnivals or whatever, there's a tournament where that was like a really big match. And you know, the Dory and Inoki would not have been on that list because that was JWA. That was before All Japan. But Dory Funk Jr. and Jumbo Tsuruta, you know, like their matches were classics. Yeah, you know, just, and again, you know, I mean, when he died and when I was thinking about it, it's like, I probably know more about, just because I knew him and everything, I probably know more about Dory Jr.'s career than like almost anyone, you know what I mean? Like almost any wrestler I could think of, you know, maybe even more than Ric Flair or, you know, Patterson or whatever, just because, you know, I saw so much, but I also talked so much with him about, you know, different things and different matches and, you know, just that whole thing and all of the controversies and the politics, you know, of the starting of All Japan and, you know, the, I probably, you know, I should write about it. I probably should, because I did not talk about this story with Brian, and it's actually a really big story. And I actually had several people ask me to talk about it on the show. And it is the story of the championship change. So he's supposed to lose, and it's actually where I finished the story in The Observer. So March 2, 1973, Houston, Texas, was supposed to be the title change, where Jack Briscoe would beat Dory Funk Jr. to win the title. February 28th, the story is that Dory got a truck accident on the ranch, fell into the ditch, separated his shoulder, and was not going to be able to wrestle for a certain length of time. And the match was canceled, and Paul Bosch, you know, obviously furious, as a promoter getting the championship change and all that, and he ended up getting it later, but, you know, because Jack Briscoe ended up winning over Harley Race in Houston, Texas, after Harley had beaten Dory. So forever and ever and ever, there's always been this, the idea that it was an angle arranged by Dory Funk Sr. to avoid Dory Jr. losing to Jack Briscoe, because, Dory Sr. from day one, as if you could read this story, you could see from, you know, just how he started his son's career. He had marketed in West Texas Dory Jr. as the greatest technical pure wrestler in the world, like the next Luthez, right? That's what Dory Jr. was in the West Texas territory. And so the idea was, like, he didn't want Dory Jr. to lose to Jack Briscoe in a straight wrestling match. You know, this has been the conjecture. What I could say is that, you know, many, many people have thought that the accident was a work. Mm-hmm. And I cannot give an answer. Only I can tell you, though, that, decades later, you know, I got, you know, medical stuff, photos, everything, you know, the same stuff that they sent Sam Mushnick and everything like that. And I remember Sam, you know, later would say that, like, look, they sent us all this stuff. It certainly looked legit, but Sam was still always skeptical, and everyone was skeptical. Everyone was, and why wouldn't you be? Like, the guy's about to lose his title after 4 years, and he gets in this ranch accident. You know, Terry and Dory always told me that it was legit, that he really got into the accident. You know, it changed the course of history. Dory came back in, this was February 28th. He came back. He did not wrestle until, I don't have the date in front of me, but it would be, you know, around May 15th ish. He started back in the territory, and Terry was just like, look, you know, it's like, you know, it hurt our territory. You know, Dory couldn't wrestle. Dory had big dates that he would have made a lot of money in, although not as champion, during that period. You know, but people thought it was Dory Sr.'s mastermind plan to avoid Dory Jr. losing to Jack Briscoe. It's absolutely always been the story. And then he wrestled a couple of dates in his territory. And then May 24th, 73, he was booked to wrestle Race, Harley Race. And it was like no ifs, ands, or, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. I mean, Mushnick was like furious. You know, I actually contacted Vince's father, you know, about like, you know, I'm tired of these shenanigans. But anyway, when he was supposed to wrestle Race in Kansas City, and that was the title change. He did not wait for Briscoe for whatever reason. And the reason was, is that they believed, you know, like Harley Race was the toughest guy, and more so, like if Harley Race was ordered to beat Dory Funk Jr., the Funks and Harley Race had a great, great, great relationship. Harley worked the Amarillo territory, and Harley was considered like the real tough guy. And he was told, like, if it's, you know, if you have to win that way, you have to win that way. There was no problems. There was no whatever. Dory lost. They did a finish. I saw the match. It's 53 years ago, but I know the finish was Dory had the match won, and the ref, was looking the wrong way or something. And he was arguing with the ref. Harley gets him from behind and hits the suplex and pins him, which, you know, now is just a normal finish. Back then, it was an incredibly controversial finish, but that footage was there. It was sent everywhere. Dory Sr. could put it on his TV that Dory really had the match won, but the referee screwed up, and it was in Kansas City, Harley Race's hometown. So they had their out, okay, of Dory losing the title in their territory. And, you know, that's what happened. Dory lost the title, and then Jack on July the 20th in Houston beat Race. So you still had the Dory Funk Jr. Jack Briscoe angle unresolved, to go all over the country with the 60 minute matches. And this time Jack is the world champion against Dory after, you know, many years of Dory retaining it with Jack and by the, you know, skin of his teeth. And now Jack is the champion who never beat Dory in a championship match. And so Jack and Dory continued their feud throughout the entire reign of Jack Briscoe. And the Terry championship win, which is December 10, 1975 in Miami Beach. So that was during the tag team tournament, I believe. But whatever it was, Dory was in Japan. They advertised the match as Jack against Dory. It sold out, you know, South Beach, the convention center, because Jack and Dory, I don't know how many times they wrestled in Miami, but it was always a big, big, big draw. And, you know, it was just another one, and it was the classic match and all that. And, you know, so they get there, and there's the cameras are there, which maybe that happened like, I don't know, once, twice a year. They'd bring the cameras to Miami when they're going to shoot a big angle. Almost all the angles were shot at the Bayfront in St. Petersburg, but mostly in Tampa, you know, because that's where the promotion was based, in Tampa. Sometimes, you know, like they would shoot stuff every now and then in the other cities, right? You know, just to kind of keep it honest, but the cameras were rarely brought to Miami. So people were kind of, something big's happening. I mean, they didn't know it was a world title change, but they knew something big was happening. I remember that. And then Dory doesn't show up, and Terry wrestles Jack. And I mean, I remember they aired this match on Roy Shire's TV like 2 weeks later. And the Terry Jack match, it was like, that's the best match I'd ever seen up until that point, you know, because it was just such a great technical match. And Terry won the championship. But Jack had his out, in the sense that he was preparing for Dory. Terry's a completely different style wrestler. And so that allowed Jack to maintain face as, in Florida, the greatest technical wrestler, losing, you know, to a small package, to a cradle off the figure four, a reversal. But it allowed Jack to save face. So that was like Eddie Graham's thing. And, you know, Jack remained a top contender for Terry, although by that point, Jack was very, very burned out on the travel of wrestling. And he actually took a lot of time off and you know, didn't wrestle all that much. But you know, they did that to keep face and then to save face. And when Terry's champion, you know, obviously Dory is not getting any championship matches. So Dory's role was to go into different territories and face the top baby face and basically be the bounty hunter, you know, for Terry, you know, like in just here, like Dory would come to Los Angeles to wrestle Chavo Guerrero and they'd have a big feud and Chavo would beat him. And the story is always like Dory's actually the better wrestler of the two. So Chavo beat Dory. That means he's got a great chance of beating Terry when Terry would come in. And that was kind of Dory's role during the Terry championship run. Terry sort of at the latter stages of the of Dory's role. That's how Terry actually became a big star, was he would come into places and lose matches to the top baby face to set up Dory getting it. So that was one of the beauties of the Funk brothers and being world champion, is that they had two brothers who were main event stars with great, great, great credibility. And they could use that to build up, you know, title contenders in every territory. I mean, that was like Dory would, you know, you go to Florida, you beat Dory, and then, you know, you're set up for, you know, Terry, you know, and that's really where, you know, Dusty Rhodes and Terry got really big. Dusty chasing Terry as champion, but always having to go through Dory. And then you had the tag team matches with the Funks against Dusty and a million different partners, all the different baby faces in Florida. And, you know, and that even happened before, you know, with the Funks and the Briscoes, you know, who had that, you know, probably were starting to wrestle each other as tag teams, you know, while Dory was champion. You know, the Funks and Briscoes tag team matches were big, big things, always to lead to Dory against Jack, occasionally Dory against Jerry, you know. So yeah, that was so anyway, that's the story of the title changing, kind of like the psychology of you know, Dory's role as a beatable world champion who ended up holding it for 4 years, and then being the policeman for Terry during Terry's reign as champion.
Okay, so I have a question, but before I get to my question, for next week, because you're going to write a longer piece, if folks do have questions after reading this week's issue or next week's issue, send me emails, garrett@f4wonline.com, and we will kick off the show unless something crazy happens and we have bigger news, and we can get through some questions for next week. Okay, so my question, this idea of the beatable world champion, it seems a little more foreign to me based on today's wrestling. Like we have, you know, even when, you know, Ospreay lost that one match when he's coming back from injury, and people are like, oh, but he's going to All In. Why is he losing? Like, what's going on here? Just the idea that somebody who's going to be headlining a show looks weak is a little bit foreign to some of the stuff that we watch. And Omega too, right? Omega selling, you know, like he's going to lose. It's like, oh man, we need him to be strong. He's going to defend the title. Like
that's the exact opposite of what they did in the in that period.
Right. You know? So who would be?
I mean, when I say exact opposite, it's like what Omega did. You know, in particular, the way Omega worked. I mean, that was the way. That's the way. You know, that's the thing. That's the way the top guys in that era all worked. You know, in the sense of. You know, especially like here in the territory I grew up with Roy Shire, it was like every match with Ray Stevens against the lowest job guy would still on TV go 12 to 14 minutes. And the guy would have Ray Stevens just about beat and just about beat and just about beat. And that was the whole beauty of it, is that Ray got every single, Pat Patterson was the same way. They got every single wrestler in the territory over from the opening match guy to whatever. So you believed, you know, when you saw your opening match that these were really damn good wrestlers. Mm-hmm. Like everybody on the card was a good wrestler because, you know, they took the great Ray Stevens to the limit and it solidified the entire card. And, and Buddy Rose in Oregon was the same way. If you ever watch Buddy Rose stuff in Oregon, it's like, it didn't matter who he was against. He was always on the verge of losing, which was actually his heat. You know, the heat, Stevens and Patterson heat was not like Buddy Rose's heat. It was different. But that was like the whole thing. So like, I always like, you know, Buddy Rogers was the one, you know, when Buddy Rogers would do a TV match, he always sold for the TV guy, who's usually an unknown. And, you know, people would go like, why? And Buddy would go, because if I beat a guy with no struggle and I beat a guy, because I've accomplished nothing, you know, I make the guy look like he's a world beater. And then when I beat him, I beat somebody and I help the guy, you know, for the future, because he, you know, he could almost beat the world champion. So that was the mentality of, you know, really all the top workers back then, you know. I mean, now it's like, you know, it's a different time, but the reality is that so many of the top workers, and Omega's one of them, you know, all over, that's, they still have that exact same mentality. It's just some people are so fed brained, you know, that they don't understand that psychology at all.
What does that mean?
You know, they only watch WWE or they,
okay, think that's what I thought that
when they think the way WWE does it is right. And I mean, even today, I mean, the funny part about all this is that, like, you know, If you had a match and you had, you know, like on the Thursday night show at Arena Mexico, just as an example, where it's not necessarily the top guys. Now it's kind of like whatever. So guys that are not main eventers would be in there with like a Dorada or somebody like that. It's like they're getting tons of offense on the guy. You know, Mystico's not going to work on a Thursday, I don't think. But, you know, like the guys that are the top guys, they're going to go, you know, the length of time, the 15, 17 minutes, they're going to sell for the underneath guy to make the underneath guy look like he's a main eventer because he's in the main event, you know, or whatever. I mean, that's just how it is. And it's how it's, you know, it's really how it's always been in wrestling. It's just weird because like so many of the basic stuff that you do, it kind of like blows my mind sometimes because when I hear people or read people and they're trying to explain like this thing, it's like, well, you never studied wrestling because, I mean, it's like back then that's what it was, but it's like, oh, that's back then. And it's like, well, guess what? You know, today it's the same. That's what they do in AEW. That's what they do in New Japan. That's what they do in NOAH. That's what they're going to do in CMLL. You know, the idea is to make a match. It's not like
it's Chuck Liddell versus who is that one guy that he had to fight, and they put that guy over huge in the in the countdown, when everyone knew they had no chance, but people bought it and they actually bought that pay-per-view. I forget that guy's name, but even in the early UFC run before.
Well, that, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that, you know, again, you know,
what was that guy's name?
Oh, do you mean Jeremy Horn?
Yes, that guy.
Jeremy Horn gave Frank Shamrock a real fight, you know, years earlier. But yeah. Like at that stage and everything like that, he wasn't going to beat Chuck Liddell.
Okay. So here's my question. So I'm reading these 85 observers and Crockett is going into New York and running shows in New York. And I think that one of the early main events that you're talking about is like Jimmy Garvin and Ric Flair or something. And you wrote something to the effect of, when WWE has Hogan beating everybody in 7 minutes, doing the Ric Flair act is not going to excite this market.
Yep. Because they were used to, although Bruno sold, but they were used to Hogan at that point. And when you saw the dominant Hulk Hogan as champion, and then you saw the Ric Flair, you know, who had better matches, at that point, you know, like they were still in their tunnel. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you have to fight fire with the world championship. Now, if it was Ric Flair against Steamboat, Ric Flair against Harley Race, Ric Flair against the top guy doing that, mm-hmm. or, you know, even like in certain cases with, you know, an arena match with a Brad Armstrong or whatever, but there's still the thing with Flair wasn't so much the selling. I think the selling was always fine, but the finishes were not fine. You know, Hulk Hogan always won with a leg drop, right? Mm-hmm. And Ric Flair never won with a figure four. And I think that was the problem, was the finishes, not as much. Cause I think that the drama of the world title match, you know, I mean, I didn't really see a lot of Ric Flair matches that didn't get over, mm-hmm. you know, as far as like, as it was going, but I did see, you know, in cities where the business really declined, you know, the bullshit finish and the bullshit finish and the bullshit finish. And yes, that declined as compared to Hulk Hogan, where, you know, even if you might do a DQ here and there, in the end, he's winning the rematch with a leg drop and you're getting the finality, and Flair never got the finality. So I think that was more of a thing than necessarily the selling part of it, maybe.
So Alan has a question kind of related to it. He said, you described Dory Funk Jr.'s strength as NWA champion as being credible enough to represent the title, but vulnerable enough that fans believe the local challenger might beat him. Has modern wrestling confused protecting the champion with protecting the title? And who, since Dory, do you think has been best at making challengers stronger without diminishing themselves?
Race was very good at it. Flair was fantastic at it. The difference with Race and Flair, and it got worse with Flair as compared to Dory, is that the world title was the world champion. It was so up until I believe 75 or so, the NWA world champion was booked by Sam Mushnick, and you know, there's a lot to that. So Dory's whole reign is booked by Sam Mushnick. He gives him his schedule, and there were certain rules, you know, and it's like you could only do a certain number of 60-minute matches, you know, and Dory did a lot of them, but it was like, I don't know what the number was, maybe 3 a week, let's just say. But there was a number where you know, just to kind of whatever. And, you know, you could do your DQ finishes at times to build rematches, but it was to build rematches. You couldn't do like Dory punches the referee to save the title and then never comes back and faces the guy again. You couldn't do that. He would not, you know, I mean, I'm sure some promoters tried to get away with it, but that was like a pretty, you know, strict rule in the sense that in the end, the world champion is going to win. You know, it's going to be a close match. It's going to be a dramatic match and everything like that. But in the end, he's going to be the world champion. You know, like that's the thing. Once when Mushnick no longer booked the champion, which, you know, shows the you know, there was a lot to that. That was like in the 75 in 75, I think, NWA meeting, roughly. It might have been 76. But the two things there were, number one is, you know, Mushnick would get 2.5% of the gate of every championship match as the booker of the world champion. You know, so Barnett took over as booker. You know, they Sam resigned, but, you know, I mean, and Dory was actually the one who like explained the whole politics of Sam resigning to me. Sam resigned on his own because he got fed up with the other promoters. You know, kind of like, I built this thing, we're making money. The NWA champion has been a very, very successful aspect of the business. And guy, you know, the promoters are starting to complain about why we got to pay you 2.5% of the gate, you know, like that. And he felt insulted, so he quit. And Dory said that, you know, it was kind of a thing to, you know, you can't fire Sam. You know what I mean? You have to make him quit. And the mentality was, if, well, we insult him, he'll, you know, the way Sam is, he'll quit, which is in fact what happened. But Barnett was waiting on to be the NWA champion booker and was not, you know, he was just doing for fun. You know, he it wasn't so much the money, but the importance and the power. And the funny part is, so Sam's the world champion supposed to book. I mean, the NWA president was supposed to book the world champion. Barnett booked the world champion. He was not NWA president because in 1975, the NWA was not going to have a gay president. Believe it or not, that was the reason that he was never NWA president. So he was treasurer, which meant he controlled the money and he was really the most powerful guy, but you know, they would use like Jack Atkinson, Fritz Von Erich, or Geigel, or, you know, other guys were the president. But Barnett was booking the champion, so that was like the real power. But once Barnett's booking the champion, you know, Barnett didn't give a shit about what the champion did finishes. Right? Like, Sam monitored their finishes, monitored, you know, like protecting only a certain number of 60-minute matches. With Barnett, which was another reason why the promoters, you know, aside from saving their 2.5%, another reason why the a lot of the promoters like Barnett is that they would get no blowback. They could do whatever they wanted for finishes. And, you know, Terry, who was like the first champion, you know, he's just going to do what they wanted. He didn't, you know, he wasn't going to, you know, like whatever, like protect, you know, he was just whatever. He, you know, Harley the same way. Like, they might have a qualm and they might say something or things like that, but essentially, like, they're doing what the promoter asked, you know, with the idea it's the best thing for the territory. Whereas Sam thought that the overriding the world championship was the best thing for wrestling, and not, you know, not necessarily the champion shouldn't be, I don't say the best thing for the territory, but, you know, he had his rules. And once these other guys were champion, there were no rules. And because of that, you know, you had a lot of fucked finishes. And because of that, I think that the aura of the world championship was not the same as it was with Dory, and to an extent with Jack Briscoe and Kaniski and the other champions. But Dory sort of hit that sweet spot.
Robert wanted to follow up on what you and Brian were talking about whether Dory Senior and Junior did have issues with Jack Briscoe or not, or if that was just all.
Jack always thought Senior did. I don't, you know, like, you know, the story that I said, right? And, you know, the idea is that, like, Dory didn't want, you know, his son to lose to Jack. You know, the thing is on this is, you know, like, literally, like, right after Dory loses the title, Dory Sr. dies. So, you know, it's like, at that point, you know, it's like, All the stories were, you know, like that he didn't want Junior to lose to Jack ever. And that may very well be true, you know, and that's certainly how history has written it. You know, I don't know, you know, Jack definitely did not like Dory Senior. He thought that, you know, Dory Senior's thing was, you know, Jack was real and he was NCAA champion and, you know, probably could have gone to the Olympics. He was that good. But he turned pro wrestler instead. And it was like he felt that Dory Sr. used Dory because in the Amarillo territory, you know, I think Jack came in and he was one of the guys that, you know, that Dory would beat with the idea that, hey, you know, I mean, Dory never won an NCAA title. He did not even wrestle in college, but he beat an NCAA champion. So that's how good of a wrestler he is. That was the way that Dory was promoted. Dory Jr. was promoted in Amarillo because that's Dory Sr. kind of got over. I mean, the whole the Amarillo thing, you know, with Amarillo. So Dory Sr., you know, the Funks are from Hammond, Indiana. They're not from Texas. And they're traveling around and the guy, Amarillo was a territory that was built around really tough dudes, you know, where the idea is that they would get into fights in bars and all that stuff that you know, it was true. And, you know, they had this guy, Wayne Martin, who was like 160 pounds, but he's like a Hall of Fame, like real wrestler, 3-time NCAA champion, badass guy, right? He was the top guy in the territory as the Southwest junior heavyweight champion. And Dory Sr., you know, who was also, you know, a junior heavyweight. He was not a real heavyweight. He was smaller and everything like that, you know, comes in and he was a college wrestling star. And Dory Sr. ends up becoming, you know, as Wayne Martin is phasing out, although they were not that different in age. I think Wayne Martin's maybe a couple of years older than Sr. But anyway, Dory Sr. is becoming the top guy. And then he gets a percentage of the promotion. So he stays. And, you know, he was the badass street fighter and all that, but he's not necessarily a big guy. So, I mean, I just remember like I had met someone, you know, because the Funks never told me this, But I remember meeting someone who went to, was friends in high school with Terry. And they were, you know, like, oh, how was Terry in high school? And it was like, you know, everyone in school knew that Terry's dad is like the toughest street fighter anywhere, because they all grew up with the stories in town. Not only was on TV pro wrestling winning these Texas death matches and these bloody brawls with Mike DiBiase and all these guys, right? But they all heard the bar stories too, or the restaurant stories or whatever. And it's like, so it's, and, you know, both Dory and Terry were very good athletes also as well. They were, you know, they were not NFL football players, but they were, you know, solid starters in a Division I program, you know, linemen and everything. And, you know, in high school, obviously they were, you know, dominant high school players, and they knew because of their dad. I mean, they knew how to fight, you know. Although, I mean, I never heard stories from either of them ever talking about being kids in street fights ever. I mean, maybe it's just the rep. I don't know. But, you know, I don't know. Dory wasn't the type who would talk to me about that. Terry would have been, but Terry never really did either. So I don't know that they really got in fights, but their father's reputation in that town was like, you know, and Senior did get into fights, you know, because he's a smaller guy thinking he had to prove himself as the top wrestling star in the territory, especially because not being a big guy, you know, people would, you know, in Texas, the big cowboy guys, right? He's not really that big, you know, and wrestling's fake and all this. And you know, Dory's thing, you know, which Dory learned and Terry learned from their father, you know, but I never heard of any stories that they actually did this, is that, you know, if you get into a fight with some guy, it's like, you know, you're not out wrestling them and choking them out. You're beating the shit out of him, because if his face isn't messed up, he's going to say, oh, I got into a fight with Dory Funk Sr. And, you know, I survived. It's like, no, you're gonna look like you didn't survive that fight. And you can't, the whole thing is, you are not going to be bragging to your friends that I survived a fight with Dory Funk Sr. And Dory Funk Sr. would fight anyone who questioned if wrestling was legit and got in his face, you know, and you know, it happened at embarrassing times. But you know, that's the world that they grew up in. It's different world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll have more next week. And again, send those questions, Garrett, at F4WOnline.com. So you wrote about David Ellison's op-ed and where he is defending himself and why the merger should go through. And he was quiet and he was letting people tell his story, and that is no more. And yet I'm reading it and I'm going like, well, the whole way you could have told people that CNN wasn't going to be compromised was CBS News not being compromised.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so it's like you had your opportunity and you told people what the intention is, and now you're kind of bit in the butt here.
Yeah. It's funny because there were the two stories this last week, and you know, one of them big and one of them absolutely minor, but that one would be the big one, that it's like, David writes this, and it's, you know, I'm gonna do the news like it's supposed to be done. You know, you don't have to fear this, you know, because, you know, the big thing, why this is such a big political thing, is the idea of CNN turning into a right wing propaganda. And the problem is that with CBS News, I mean, you know, reporters quit, reporters had stories nixed that were unfavorable to Trump. The network backed down in that lawsuit that most people think they didn't, you know, there's no way they could have ever lost, you know. They basically backed down and their news department went to hell, and that's under Ellison. And now he's saying that with CNN, you don't have to worry about it, where it's all going to be independent and everything. And it's like, yeah, you already had your chance to prove that. And, you know, this is not about right wing versus left wing. This is about reporters doing their job. And they were just told, hey, you need to, you know, like they were told outright, you need to change your slant a little bit, you know, where you don't want the administration mad. And it's like, well, if that's the thing, then people who are, you know, of course, one side is going to be upset with that, because in the side versus side. But if you're just a fan of, or someone who just believes in news as it should be presented, all of this is horribly, horribly offensive. And, you know, and now, I mean, that version of news is going away. I recognize that, obviously. It's not nothing I'm happy about, but it is what it is. And, you know, he's trying to go, oh, no, we're going to do that news. You know, and it's like, you had your chance, you know, and now you're saying it. It's like, that's why you're in this mess. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for that, you wouldn't be in this mess. They'd have gotten their merger. They would, I mean, or they're buy. But then the funniest part of the whole thing is they wouldn't have spent $111 billion to get this thing. If it wasn't for the fact it was currying favor by removing CNN as opposition to Trump, that's the reason they spent so much in the first place. I mean, and he's trying to, you know, act like, why are you holding it against me? We're going to be fair. And it's like, you wouldn't spend that kind of money in the first place to get this thing if it wasn't about this. So, yeah, that was that. So the other one was the Nick Khan one with Busted Open Radio, where it was like, oh, you know, like, you know, if we need to be criticized, you know what I mean? If we need to be criticized, you know, you go do it. And it's like, we already saw what happened with ESPN. I mean, it's like, if that never happened, you know, Nick's a good talker, you know? I mean, he'll tell you that. I'm sure that, you know, like, I know from, you know, and it's like, if, you know, I'm not saying this is the reason Andres Hale got fired. Okay. I mean, I, you know, I don't know that. I do know there was a reason that he was no longer allowed to give letter grades to WWE pay-per-view shows. And it wasn't like it was unfair. It wasn't like he's given three straight shows Fs. He gave one show a C that was probably a C-, but whatever, you know. And it's like if you want fair and unbiased coverage, that people willing to say the things that are wrong, then you would welcome him. You would welcome all people who were, and it's like, if you look at the reporters that they, you know, I mean, you know, you could just look at it. It's like who they, you know, who gets interviews and who doesn't get interviews and all that stuff. It's like, you know, and not even that, just the press conferences and just everything, you know, like, you know, when they used to do the press conferences, it was like, you know, did they want the credibility of real reporters being there? Yes. Did they want them asking real questions? You know, certainly seems like no, you know, I mean, looking at history. So, and, you know, like on WWE radio, you know, they might go in there and say something negative just to prove, it's like some soft pedal thing. You know, you probably have to do that at certain points just to show that you're really not, but you are, you know, you are, you're WWE radio. I mean, like, again, Thunder Rosa was let go. I mean, we all knew it was going to happen, but she was. But there it is. There's your answer. I mean, if they really believed in that, the first thing they would do is say, cover everyone. And they're certainly not going to let the AEW wrestler go from the show, because that's the one thing where they can point, hey, we're not against anyone, and we're just wanting them to do the best fair wrestling show. No, if you wanted that, you know, you wouldn't hire the guys, you know, beforehand, and you know what I mean? And you wouldn't have them only talk about you. And there's so many different things. It's like I say, you know, I mean, I saw people printing, oh, Nick wants them to do this. And it's like, Nick's got a, whatever, WWE's got a track record. I mean, it's like, that's it. It's like, you know, words are words. Actions are actions. Actions speak louder than words.
Now, a real version of this story that I find kind of interesting is our own local sports station out here that I worked for way back in the day.
Are you going to talk about Greg Papa?
Well, it's related.
This is actually a really big story here, and because of Dory Jr. dying, I have not delved into it, so I only know the headlines. That station is like, I've never seen such outrage, and to me, obvious. It's you know. So tell me about this, all of this, okay?
Because I don't know this. I haven't dug too much into the Papa thing. Only thing that I know is that a story came out on him. It was either earlier this week or late last week. He's dealing with cancer. He's in bad shape. And he's very much about, you know, I'm going to make a comeback. I'm still going to be able to do this. And obviously, it's costing him a lot of money to fight this thing. And so he's the voice of the 49ers, used to be the voice of the Raiders. When I was a kid, he was the voice of the Warriors. So he has been around this area for a very long time. And so a couple days after this story comes out about how he's trying to fight it and eventually get back and call 49er games, it comes out that the KNBR fires him from his daily job. And the thing about that is, it wasn't very hard for him to use his home setup to actually get on the air with his co-host. It's physically impossible for him, to get to the, you know, to a 49ers game and actually go into the studio and do it. And so that was kind of like he was able to still do some stuff, but I think he had actually not done much of late. And so they fired him from that role and they did a big shakeup. It's just been all negative, and big negative thing about him. You see a lot of people who've worked with him and just people who are, you know, I come from radio, like not, and I'm not tooting my own horn here, but I remember very clearly being in the studio in like 1999 and thinking, should I try and go this route? Or will the same five guys who are on air now be on air in 10 years? And I chose to leave and go into the stuff that I do today. And I actually talked to somebody who he kind of does KNBR stuff, but he's also does his own stuff. His name is Larry Krueger. I worked with him when I was a kid. And I told him the story. I was like, I came to this conclusion because I looked at who was doing the shows and I thought these people are going to be there in 10 years. Not only were they almost all of them there in 10 years, like they were still there like 15 years later. So I made the right decision. But what is terrestrial radio in 5 years? Like how does that business look? Because KNBR in of itself is, you know, the sports leader, the giant sports thing. They have the Warriors. They have the Giants. I think the Giants are partial owners. And now the story is that the Giants are angry at them because of the coverage, which has been negative because the Giants are not good. Mm-hmm. And Buster Posey has been getting criticized. And they had a hot mic incident where I think an assistant producer may have said something that made air that was negative about him that should not have made air. But it's like, you know, this is a similar scenario. The team owns the station, and now the station is being critical of the team, and the team is very mad at the scenario.
Yeah.
I'm like, we do podcasts. Brian and Tony Leader in 2005 were like, hey, we can do this audio stuff from home. Like, we don't even have to use a radio station to do this. And now it's 20 years later, and we're still doing this. Terrestrial radio still exists. Satellite radio still exists. I just don't know what that business looks like in the next 5 years.
Well, same as like the cable business. Well,
your friend who got let go from the news, was it Chris Cruz?
Chris Cruz. Yeah. I wouldn't call him my friend, but I know him and he's a reader and you know, I mean, he emails me from time to time. Yeah. You know, I mean, he didn't get low. They shut down the whole thing, which is another thing, you know, which, and I don't know how much Ellison had to do with that decision, but in the list of things where I've read his decisions, that's also on the list, that he took this 99 year, almost ready to hit number 100 year anniversary, CBS News Radio. And it's been part of, you know, culture or whatever, and he shut it down saying it wasn't cost effective, you know, just a couple of months ago. And yeah, it put it ended the, you know, I don't know what Chris is doing now. He's I know financially he's okay, because I have heard enough about that that it's not like that, but yeah, you know, he's I don't know today, but I know at first, you know, because he, you know, Chris actually did the final, and I heard it, you know, I was on the road listening on Sunday nights, like I almost always am. And I was listening to the final edition of CBS News ever. And Chris was the anchor. And afterwards, it was just like, you know, on his ship, you know, like on, he was jonesing, like, I need to go in and do the news. And there's no news to do. It's like, you know, there you go.
Yeah, I remember being in journalism class, radio TV journalism class, and like as a part of like our literal day-to-day homework for that class is, if you're driving, you got to listen to CBS News. If you're you know, in the car or at home, and you just need to be caught up in how they do things, because this is now your life. And then I was like, I kind of just want to do sports. I don't want to do real news. But so I don't know how much of this is my life. But yeah, like that was a big deal when I was in school. All right. So the WWE financial stuff around WrestleMania, I know you and Brian ran out of time. You didn't get a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, there really isn't much. I mean, obviously, like, you know, I mean, I'd say read the issue, because I mean, the key thing, I guess, that I went through was, you know, like the, you know, their profit margins are huge, you know, and I mean, it's the nature of the business. If they were paying, this goes WWE and UFC, and I know there's no unrest, you know, money wise in WWE, because the guys make a lot of money. They're all making more money than they ever dreamed they would make. You know, it's like, I'm sure that, you know, whatever, like most of the wrestlers in WWE, maybe not all of them, but most of them, would do this for, you know, I mean, a lot less money than they're making, put it that way, 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 way less. And they also deserve way, way more than they're making at the same time, because, you know, the business is so lucrative, you know, in so many different directions. So, but I basically said, like, if they were making, you know, UFC fighters, and UFC fighters are not happy with what they make, you know, because they're getting beat up, and also, you know, like the amount of money, like the amount of money, the total salaries of all the WWE talent and all the UFC talent is pretty close. The number is pretty close, but there's like 600 UFC fighters, let's say, under contract. I don't know if that's exact number, but it's in that range, right? And there's maybe 200 WWEs, but, you know, half of them are developmental, who aren't making much. So the ones, the ones that we see on TV on Raw and SmackDown, the ones on the main roster, they're all doing great, like far, far, far beyond their dreams of what they ever thought they would make in pro wrestling, you know, partially because revenues increased, and more so because AEW exists and it's raised everyone's salary. So I never hear from wrestlers complaining about their money. I hear from about fighters complaining about their money constantly. But you know, they're both underpaid and at around the same level. You know, I mean, I think, you know, realistically both should make triple what they make. And I actually ran some numbers, and it's like, if they got paid triple what they made now, both companies would be super profitable. Not nearly the extent they are, but they would be. But there's no, you know, is there an impetus to change? I mean, like, you know, there was a court case with UFC fighters. Obviously they fared very well in that case, you know, and then there's still another one coming, you know? So, you know, I mean, it was not ruled in court they underpaid their talent and stifled competition, but they certainly settled to avoid that trial. And if something like that were to come up with UFC, I mean, with WWE, I mean, the result, if it once it got through the process, would probably be there. I think the difference is with UFC, there were some fighters who publicly backed UFC. I think with WWE wrestlers, like, I, you know, but a lot of them, you know, didn't. I think with WWE wrestlers, you know, I think it'd be hard to get, you know, the Kung Lee and the Fitch, Kyle Kingsbury, Nate Quarry, those guys who were the, you know, the guys who were there on the ground floor to start it. I think it would be very hard to round those people up in WWE for fear of, you know, for just the fear of them ruining their own careers and their dreams and things like that. I know that, you know, look, it's the same case. You know what I mean? It's the same company. It's the same case. If they actually went through with it, these lawyers are now experienced at it. If they went through this case against WWE, in their minds, it will be the same end result, probably. It may not be because AW may have been the thing that shows there is competition. They haven't killed all competition, and salaries did rise due to competition. So it does make it a little tougher case. Before AEW, it's the exact same case. And the fact that, you know, I mean, the reason that there was no lawsuit over this, I mean, reason number one was is they weren't going to do another one while the WWE thing, I mean, the UFC thing was going on. Reason number two is now, maybe AEW, maybe inability to find their Kung Lee, you know, the guy who's going to be front and center and stand up. With UFC, you could get that because these were guys who were 40 years old and their career was in the past. In wrestling, if you're 40 years old, you know, or 50 years old, you still want to come back, you know, for still have that dream. So it's really hard to get, you know, a high profile name to be the spearhead guy in that type of litigation. So, but anyway, but you know, it is identical in a lot of ways. And anyway, so I'm just saying that I ran through that. But the other thing that I thought in the filings that was the most interesting, and I, you know, came out of nowhere, didn't see it, you know, coming or anything like that. You know, they're just going through the thing, and the revenue for the quarter, for, you know, in most things, it's WWE's up, you know, sponsorships up, TV rights, obviously those are fixed numbers and they're up, you know, they escalate every year. You know, merchandise is doing well. I mean, overall they're doing great. They're doing fantastic. However, live ticket revenue, you know, and we know the live tickets aren't as hot now as they were a year ago. That's not, you know, that's not a big revelation. But the live ticket revenue for WrestleMania or for the quarter was down, I think, $33 million in the quarter. Okay, you know, I'm thinking, if I just saw that, I'm going like, you know, it's actually a pretty big drop, but, you know, I mean, obviously the gates aren't going to be as big as 2024, 2025, where they're setting records in every city every time out. You know, they're not at the peak anymore. So no biggie. The thing that was in the call was when they said that 33 million drop, that it was largely almost all due to the decline in the gate of WrestleMania. And that was like, okay, we all knew WrestleMania was down this year. Mm-hmm. I think 16%, right? And, you know, in attendance. Okay. So, you know, like if they're down 16%, you know, if they're down 16% of their $66 million gate of the year before, yeah, I would have figured it was half. So it's either this WrestleMania, they had to discount. And you remember the original tickets for WrestleMania were more expensive than 2025, not less.
Yeah, we thought that because of that, they might actually get close to the gate from the previous year, but didn't happen.
I thought when they first announced the tickets, I thought it was a given that they would beat the gate. Then at the end, when ticket sales were a lot slower, it was like, well, they may still equal the gate, even though they're going to be down 15%, you know, or even 20% tickets, because it was hovering in that range every week. And it's like, well, they're going to be down. But, you know, with the ticket price increase, they'll probably be near the gate. And then when the show was over and it was, you know, no bragging about gate records, it's like, well, okay, they didn't beat last year's gate. You know, last year's gate, they did 33 million both nights, 66 million total, like two of the biggest gates in the history of combat sports ever. I mean, only, you know, a handful, you know, like Mayweather, McGregor, and I think Crawford and Alvarez beat it. And obviously, you know, Pacquiao and Floyd, which was the biggest ever. I mean, like, but it was only the biggest ever that were ahead of that WrestleMania. That's how big that 2025 WrestleMania was. It's gigantic. So, okay. So instead of 33 million a show, you know, 25, 28 million, it's like, you know, it's still great. Right. But half is like six, you know, maybe 17 million, right. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, which is still a good number for each night. Don't get me wrong, but I was stunned. You know, I mean, I just thought that, like, I mean, they must have either had to discount that thing like crazy or paper like crazy to get their 50,000 in the building those two nights. It was not nearly, and, you know, no one has talked about it, but it was more pronounced drop than the ticket sales indicate by a wide, wide margin. And I think the same thing was true of SummerSlam. You know, well, and I feel, you know, like, you know, I'm sure that the gate compared to the New York gates, you know, way, way, way down, because, you know, again, the way those tickets moved in that 1 week only is really weird, just really, really weird. I think that they had a tough time. Certainly they had a tough time selling tickets at the prices they expected to sell them at. And, you know, I mean, it was enough to where, you know, like I said, like they did that whole thing on Tuesday or Monday when they were going through all those numbers, and they didn't even mention SummerSlam attendance, gate, mm-hmm. anything. So it's like, that's the first time ever, you know, no press release after.
We thought when Justin Jefferson got the microphone, we thought we were going to get attendance stuff. And he was.
Yeah, just, right. Because on the second night, because they did on the first night, and I go, oh, they're going to go on there and announce 70,000, you know, or 75,000 and just combine the two nights and we'll leave it at that and everything. It's like they didn't even do that.
Mm-mm. What was the number that Vince had to pay in the shareholders lawsuit?
I believe 40, I don't have it from me. I think it's in the range of 42 million. You know, and then obviously WWE had to pay 105. So it's $147 million verdict, or not verdict, but settlement. You know, that's a big settlement. You know,
that's, I mean, still a fantastic investment for him.
What, for Vince?
Yeah.
Well, I know he's made a lot more than 42 million, you know, with that deal with the stock going up, but he did lose all his power.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know what, you know,
That's what was best for that stock, though, is him losing all that power.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Isn't it amazing, the people who are, like, nostalgic for Vince? I mean, forgetting, like, if Vince was still in charge, AEW would be so much stronger than it is now, because they were, you know, doing really, really well until that freaking Vince was out. And then as soon as Vince was out, it was like, all right, now it's a different game. You know, you don't have a guy who's going to be making own goals against you. You're going to have a guy who's going to be, you know, doing conservative booking, but he ain't going to do anything stupid, you know, or anything like that. And then he turns Cena. But you know, this turning of Cena thing, you know, in fairness, that was a bad storytelling device move and all that, but it was not like that was an economic disaster like turning Austin was. Mm-mm. You know, like it really wasn't. I mean, they still did their same business, you know, with Cena. It's just bad storytelling and all that. But you know, like the turn of Austin, you know, I mean if you look back on the turn of Austin between merch and ticket sales and everything like that, that was a you know, probably the stupidest booking move financially, other than everything WCW did, which was obviously far stupider because they went out of business. WWE only just went down.
Yeah. All right. We have a super chat question we're going to get to in a second, but I want to get through a couple of more WWE related things. So you guys talked about the Brock retirement with WrestleMania in Saudi Arabia. Why announce it now when there's a half decent chance he's going to be on that show, right?
It's a wrestling retirement.
Unless he goes into the Hall of Fame in Saudi Arabia.
I wouldn't be surprised if he goes into the Hall of Fame at all. I would almost expect it. Yeah. Yeah. I'd almost expect it for the Hall of Fame. But I mean, yeah, no, I don't know. I think there's a good shot he'll wrestle again. Everyone does. But I knew in 2025, I was told even back then that he was retiring at SummerSlam 2026. So it's not like this came out of nowhere, but, you know, it's just like AJ, you know, I mean, I think AJ's retired. I also think that he'll probably do a tag team match with his son at some point. Brock, you know, the idea of Brock and Oba as a tag team seems easy to me, you know, but he, you know, I don't know. He may just look, he's got the money. His body's beat up. He's 49 years old. A lot of guys come back because financially they have to. He's not in that position, you know, so it's possible. He's not addicted to the spotlight. You know what I mean? Like, he can just go home and hang out and, you know, watch his kids play hockey and, you know, go hunting and all the stuff that he likes. Like, wrestling has never been the thing he likes more than anything else in the world. Whereas for most wrestlers, you know, it's their life and they really have a hard time leaving it. So, you know, it's possible, but, you know, it's a wrestler retiring. That's usually an angle. Even sometimes when you think it's real, when you're the person doing it, but then 18 months later, you know, you're missing it.
If he is outside of the TKO talent roster at some point, if his contract is, or I don't know how any of that stuff works, how much money would they have to pay him for Netflix to run an MMA show with him against Cain Velasquez?
It's an interesting proposition. I mean, it'd be considerable, but probably, you know, I don't know if he wants to fight. I know Cain doesn't want to fight. Could Cain use $10 million? Absolutely. Absolutely. Brock doesn't need it, but $10 million, you know, I mean, there's a number, you know. I mean, put it this way, if they got offered what Jake Paul makes, I can't imagine either of them turning it down, not even for a second, even at their age. I mean, Brock might have qualms and just go, you know what? I'm too old to get beat up at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, $60 million is life, you know, even for me, that's a lot of money. There's a number, you know, I mean, but it's probably a high number. I don't know that Netflix is going to offer that number. But I don't rule it out. I mean, I never thought Ronda would fight again. And she did. And it wouldn't shock me if she fights again now, you know, based on what she said, you know, even though it was a one and done and that was her retirement. It's like, you know, but I think that Ronda has revenge on her mind. You know, Brock has no revenge on his mind or anything like that. It's like Brock is not sitting there, I got to get back at Cain Velasquez, you know, because of what he did to me 15 years ago. I don't think he thinks about that for a second, you know, that revenge. No. I don't think he's adverse to going against TKO, but I think it would take a lot of money for him to go against TKO. But I don't think that, like, you know, and there may be contract things where they lock him up in a Legends deal to try to keep him from doing that, for fear that could happen.
All right. Did you see the Roman bracket for the Roman tournament?
I did see it. Yeah. 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 I mean, it looks like Pentagon Phoenix finally doing a match.
So the first round matches, Penta against Laredo Kid on this upcoming Raw, Psycho Clown versus La Parca on Saturday, next Saturday's edition of AAA.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon Lee versus Elijo Dr. Wagner Jr. is on the August 17th episode of Raw. And then Rey Fénix versus El Fiscal on the same August 17th episode of Raw. So those are the first round matchups and the brackets for the winner facing Roman Reigns in Mexico City.
No, on September 14th, Raw. So probably Penta. I mean, when I first heard it, people were already talking to me about Penta. And looking at the brackets, you know, makes sense. That's a big, you know, Penta's really over there, you know, more than people think. I mean, it's really, you know, the way the politics went and everything like that. I mean, it's kind of too bad, but, you know, I mean, if you saw the first, you know, when Mystico first went with Penta in entering New Mexico, it was like, when I saw that, it's like, man, they got such a big money feud here. It's unbelievable. But Penta's going to WWE and it's not going to happen. And it didn't happen. But, you know, like, you know, when I was down there and talking to people, you know, not CML people, but fans, you know, and it was like, you know, who's really the biggest star in this country, right? And when you do that, you know, I know people will say it's Grande Americano. I saw that. It's like, nobody says Grande Americano. Everybody says Mystico, but the other one is, you know, I mean, Ray and Phoenix are the other two. I mean, Penta, not Phoenix, Ray and Penta are the other two that they will say. You know, I'm sure in WWE's mind that they think they're doing Penta a favor by having him main event Raw and getting a title match that he's going to get a lot of offense in on Roman and lose. And maybe they are, I don't know. You know, I mean, this is one that's better off a draw. You know what I mean? or Penta winning one and Roman winning one, but that will not be happening. You know, I mean, Roman's I'm sure is going to beat him. And you know, cause everyone's got their slot, and Roman's slot is above everyone's until Obafemi gets there.
Rhea Ripley's surgery. How long is she supposed to be out?
I heard they're hopeful for Royal Rumble. That was what I was told this week, and we'll see.
You know. So what do you do with Chelsea and this interim title?
I guess she's going to have to defend it. It's kind of a weird thing, you know.
I have to imagine that they thought there was a chance that Rhea was going to have surgery in booking this.
Absolutely,
match.
Absolutely.
So it's not like all of a sudden they have to change up the booking on this because now they have Chelsea as champion.
You know what though? The fact that they said interim tells me that they were going with the idea that maybe no, because if she's having surgery, you don't call it interim. You just say Rhea's having surgery. She's out 6 months. We're having a ladder match to determine the next champion. The fact that they called it interim tells me that they were holding out hope that it was going to be maybe a month or two more. And they wanted to do something they wanted a women's championship match on the show. You know, they get to give Chelsea her moment, so everybody cheers for it, but they don't really mean it. Did you see Paul? This is like Kofi Kingston and Daniel Bryan. It's like, come on. You know, it's nothing like that. This is a hand around championship that is not, you know, the main event or anything like that. And it's a goodwill gesture. The fans are, you know, they're happy with it was generally a pretty crappy ladder match because they got their result that they wanted. And, you know, someone who they know has been struggling that was told that, you know, was, you know, not a main event player is getting a championship. And it's a nice story, you know, it was a nice story to do on that day and everything. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. But this is nothing compared to Daniel Bryan or even Kofi Kingston, but certainly not Daniel Bryan. He should never have made that comparison, because as soon as he made the comparison, it's like, oh God, come on, guy. You know, you're really insulting our intelligence this bad.
Yeah, I don't know who he was even talking to when he made that comment. Like, How do you run? I mean, even if you're being the most dishonest you could possibly be, like, that's still a little out there, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Patrick Dooley. Who is Patrick Dooley?
He was EVP, an EVP, I think, senior vice president in WWE. And yeah, he was let go at the end of the month, and it was a big surprise because he's very, very close with Paul. And yeah, I mean, I was surprised to hear it. And I don't, you know the reasons other than the only thing I was told is it came from much higher than Paul. You know, it came not and higher than Nick even. So it leaves only a couple people.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to the question from earlier from Trust the Process. Unlike Zuffa and UFC, TKO is unlikely to replicate their monopoly strategy to suppress talent pay in WWE due to AEW and Tony Khan's wealth. Do you think this reality could eventually make them sell WWE if AEW continues driving costs?
Not anytime soon, because WWE's profit margin is so huge. And even if salaries continue to escalate, the profit margin is so huge. It's not a burden. It's not a negative or anything like that. I mean, WWE, even with the competition from AEW, what was it, 59.3% of all the money that goes to WWE goes right to the bottom line. It's incredible profit margins. Even if those profit margins were 40%, it's incredible profit margins, and they doubled everyone's pay. So not that reason, no. I mean, if WWE collapsed in terms of popularity, sponsors pulled out for whatever reason, just became out, you know, would they try to get rid of it? Yeah, sure, sure. It's they're not Vince McMahon with an emotional attachment to it or anything like that. But right now, I mean, you know, it's more profitable than it was 6 months ago, a year ago. And because of the, you know, the way the Netflix deal is structured, where it goes up every year, and the USA deal, the reality is that nothing, they're only going to get more profitable every year, at least for the next, whatever it is, three and a half. And then from there, you know, nobody can predict 3.5 years from now anymore. You know, I mean, my gut would say it'll still be like that because they're still a valuable company, and they're, you know, even losing popularity, they're still going to be pretty popular. But, you know, like, no, not for the next 3.5 years. And if things collapse, sure. They're not, you know, it's not in their blood. They're there completely to extract as much profit as they can from it, period. You know, and I think that's one of the reasons they're fighting AEW so hard, is so that they can get back that control that they thought that they were going to have. And then they won't have to be escalating salaries anymore. And they'd have even, you know, even bigger profits. I think that's the nature of why, you know, you're running a 6-hour show in Edinburgh, Texas on August 30th. That's going to, you know, do terrible YouTube numbers and even worse TV numbers. But you're still doing it, no, with that knowledge, just doing anything you can to take the edge off AEW, because AEW is in a, you know, a very important period in its history right now. And so because of that, you know, that's their loss leader thing mentality. It's like, you know, yeah, we'll take some short-term money losses, but if we can get rid of them, you know, if somehow we get rid of them as far as being major competition to us, it's like, you know, all these guys, you know, like, maybe we can start asking them to take pay cuts because they don't have the leverage of going somewhere else. And yeah, then just make the profit margin even bigger. But still, the profit margin is so big right now that even being in this fight with AEW, the profit margin is still super, super high.
The reason why I don't think this is going to happen is because they've shown what their strategy is, which is to pay the people who they believe are the top stars. Like
money.
Top stars, and everybody else is kind of in the middle, and you have this pipeline of NXT talent to replace anybody in the middle who decides that they either don't want to, you know, they don't want to take the pay cut or whatever, or maybe they just let them go. When you constantly have this pipeline of talent who can just come in, and you're saving money every time a new talent comes in like that, it just seems like a nice little wheel for them to keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great business. I mean, WWE and UFC are incredibly great businesses. I think from a fan standpoint, they are less fun to follow Because, you know, it's always been business, but it's just colder business, I think. You know what I mean? I mean, especially UFC. I mean, it's funny because, like, as much money as UFC makes and everything, it's like, well, you and I have talked about this, but I mean, I've talked to people like just in the last couple of weeks, and it's like, you know, I might watch, you know, like the Conor McGregor fight, but I'm not watching this stuff anymore. And a lot of the reason is just the people who, you know, the people who run the company to some people are really negative, you know, even though like Dana's been there for from the beginning. But I think that there's a thing also like a feeling on Dana, you know, because again, Dana went from a guy who this was his lifeblood and everything, right? And it's like it's really clear that, you know, maybe Dana's big passion right now is beating all the boxing guys, you know, now he's got the endless money behind him there. But it ain't the same, you know, I mean, he's checked out. I don't know, like, you know, like I haven't talked to Dana lately. So I couldn't tell you like where his head's at. And maybe that says something too, but it's, you know, I mean, I do get the idea that he's not, you know, Dana's, he's so rich and powerful, and, you know, he doesn't have that hunger that he had in, you know, 2005 when he was trying to get this thing going.
How could he?
How could he? You're right. How could he? I don't know. I think the only one like that is me. You know what I mean? And I don't even know why I do.
Do you think you're just as hungry today with your reporting as you were in 2005?
I think more so. Yeah.
Really?
Maybe not. Maybe the same. I think maybe it's just harder because there's so much more.
Is that driven by where the business is today, or is that driven by you?
I've kind of realized that I'm insane. That it's, I think it's one of those things where it's not even an addiction. Somebody told me it was an addiction the other day. I don't even think it's an addiction. I think it's something to the effect of, because the state of everything is getting worse and there's so many people who how would I say this? Everyone's got an opinion, but nobody really, you know, I mean, nobody studies it that hard. They just give an opinion without really studying it. That I kind of think that it's kind of important to be someone who's like kind of balanced and kind of understands the actual business, giving an opinion, as opposed to just flying off the handle saying, you know, oh, Roman Reigns is no good, you know, or whatever stupid thing that you see people saying. I mean, I see stuff every day where it's just like, you know, you guys just don't understand the business of this thing at all.
Okay, take away Twitter, and do you still have that same opinion?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. The you know, yeah, for sure.
Okay, but what happens when you eventually do have to stop going as hard as you're going? It's not like,
I know.
Young Cody Meltzer is taking your spot.
No one's taking my, no. I hope maybe, you know, I mean, there are people there, you know, it's like, I don't feel like I'm the last. I feel that there's a few people that are, but there's not many. I mean, you know, I mean, John Pollock, you know, obviously, but I don't feel that there's, you know, Brandon, you know, I mean, he's very, very different from me, but he does a great job.
Shout out Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics.
Yeah. You know, I mean, those guys are really, really good at what they do. They're honest. You know, I like and respect them a lot. And there's others, you know, and there's people who, you know, work hard on breaking stories and everything, you know, and are good at that.
By the way, like John Pollock on the Dark Side for Renegade.
Really? I haven't seen Dark Side because just my, you know, just trying to cover everything is I just have not watched the last few weeks of Dark Side. I did watch all the Jarrett stuff because I was really I found that to be really compelling. I think that once they did the Boss Man one, which I wanted to see, just the workload of watching everything, just
it's good, but it's not long or in depth enough to really tell his story. I don't
who think. Boss Man.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I
wanted to see that one just because, you know, I did want to see that one. I didn't really have a big compunction on Renegade. You know, when they do what this, I really would like to watch the one this week on Orndorff, right? It's Orndorff on Tuesday. Yeah. I mean, I would amazing. Like, I mean, I watched all of Orndorff's career, most of it. And you know, I mean, Orndorff's a guy, I mean, he is in the Hall of Fame. So he is gotten his due after a long time, but I do feel that he was, even by me in a lot of ways, underrated, because you saw so much of him after the injury that you forgot about how great he was before the injury. And the Hogan feud, I think that the Hogan feud, when it was happening, everything was in such a whirlwind, you know what I mean? To where the business is changing and all that. I mean, it was impressive, but I think now with, looking back and everything, you really can see that how big, you know, Hogan Orndorff feud was, business wise and everything, because, you know, they established numbers that will never be broken. There will never be a non pay-per-view, you know, one market house show that's going to draw, you know, no matter what the local sponsorship is, that's going to draw 60,000 people like Hogan and Orndorff did. It will not happen. There will never be a period where, you know, Roman Reigns and Obafemi go city to city and, you know, sell out three matches month after month after month or whatever, you know, like to do the numbers that Hogan and Orndorff did all over the country. It will not happen. I think that like hindsight has really made me appreciate him. And I mean, he was always a great worker, but then he got hurt in that feud with Hogan and he was never the same. And you remember so much of, you know, that period afterwards where he was a guy, you know, he really was. He was a guy with a, you know, the small arm, but the really ripped physique and, you know, not the greatest promo, okay promo, you know, but the aura that he had, like as Hogan's rival, especially being so much smaller than Hogan. And also, you know, just the, you know, the work in Georgia and places, Mid-South Carolina. I mean, he was a really good, solid wrestler, fantastic athlete, you know, really worked hard.
All right, we've been waiting. I've been delaying the ratings talk because I was hoping we were going to get an AEW number for Grand Slam.
Did we get one?
We did not.
Okay, I have not got anything.
So what rating stuff did you not get to talk about with Brian the other day?
Well, let me get my stuff here, actually, right in front of me. So the last number we got is Raw from a week, you know, Monday's Raw, you know, was the show after SummerSlam. So it was, you know, first and second day numbers. It was up. As far as like exact number, I don't know, but it was well up from the previous weeks, as it would be expected to be after that show. The week before was, you know, right at the same level that it's been most weeks. It got hurt by the NBA playoffs and then certainly by the World Cup. And so I figured there'd be a rebound afterwards, and there wasn't. You know, it's still right at that level, you know, right at the, 1.1 million U.S. viewers for the week, about, you know, mid 700s, you know, 723 this week, as far as live same day. So that's, you know, normal. I think this week will be up, but the pattern after one of these pay-per-views is like, yeah, it'll be up week one and maybe even a little bit week two, and then it goes back. Normally, I mean, the thing I guess maybe slightly concerning is that, when you look at history, it's like this is usually like the big time of the year for Raw, other than January to March, or January to WrestleMania, till 2 weeks after WrestleMania. We don't have the big sports competition come mid-September. It's always record lows. And this year, it's lower than it's ever been before mid-September. So there's that. SmackDown did very well, 1,379,031 for the night before SummerSlam. But I think, you know, that's the night before SummerSlam. I think last year Dolph did very well the night before SummerSlam. But really, really good number there. And I think that's pretty much it. I mean, like the Thursday numbers we already talked about.
What about NXT?
NXT was last week. I don't have NXT's numbers yet either. We were getting it's Well, I mean, I would suspect that we'll have numbers in the issues every week. We will not have the details anymore at the level that I've had before. But that remains to be seen. I mean, it's funny. There used to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 websites that you could go to every day to get, you know, the ratings from the night before. And this week was the week where Programming Insider went down. I mean, it still exists, but they don't do ratings anymore starting this week. And now there are zero. So, you know, it's going
to
be.
You need to befriend someone at Nielsen.
Yeah, no kidding. Everyone needs to. We need some friends at Nielsen. They've really cracked down, you know, and trying to, you know, I actually think that Nielsen's strategy on cracking down is going to backfire on them, because what's going to happen is that because there's no information and no discussion, there will come a time where nobody will talk about it and nobody will care. And that will lead to their, you know what I mean? I think that will lead to their value going way, way down, because the value of Nielsen is that we all talk about it. You know, whether you're in football, whether you're in basketball, whether you're in wrestling, anyone who talks about the business of these sports, you know, the big thing you talk about is the weekly ratings and what the game did and, you know, what the competition did and what the network shows did. And it's a discussion thing that by cracking down on this goes away. We don't have that thing every day talking about ratings anywhere, and it's just a secret. It's just like, you know, I mean, the networks will know, but they will not be getting the feedback on it that they did. It's gonna be, you just watch.
But don't the big time sports need it? Because how else are they going to have the leverage against these networks to get all this money?
They will get it. And we will still see the PR releases of like, you know, the Final Four, you know, or the World Series. We'll get those numbers. But I mean, the rank and file weekly baseball, basketball, you know, it will not be the talk that it was. You will not see the articles of going up, going down, all this. Certainly hurt the WNBA, you know, I think, because a lot of their momentum came from the fact that they were all of a sudden more popular, and there's no comparison. So, you know, I mean, like the World Cup, you know, I mean, those kind of numbers we'll always get. Will we, you know, I'm hoping we'll get all the wrestling numbers, but, you know, Nielsen is not. And I think that strategy, maybe I'm wrong. You know, they didn't want those numbers out there, proprietary. But I think the strategy in the long run, I think it's going to be a negative on them, but maybe they're right. Maybe nobody getting it except for the people who pay for it. But if no one's talking about it, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, will Tony Khan get his ratings every week? Yes, he will get them from WBD. Will WWE get their ratings every week from USA? Yes. But even with, like Shapiro on Tuesday, like I didn't get the impression that he knew much more. You know, when he was talking ratings, it was everything that was off the Programming Insider chart and what you would look at when you look at Netflix, you know, and you like kind of examine their stuff like I do every week. I mean, he didn't have any insights of anything that wasn't very obvious to me. And so it's not like, you know, they get them, but my gut is that like, he's just looking at it through the same places I was looking at it. I mean, Tony would, you know, gets other stuff, I'm sure, you know, but he'll make decisions accordingly. But even like, look, even with Tony, I mean, the reality is with Tony is it, he doesn't like, he knows how his TV show is doing every week, but he doesn't really know how it's doing because he doesn't even get the streaming numbers. Mm-hmm. And is that 15%? Is it 50%? Is it 70%? You know, it's like, there's a whole lot of like, how well are we doing? That's so variable that, we really don't know. And the correlation with that, like our houses are up, you know, houses and you know, the ratings are the most important thing when it comes to negotiating these deals, not if they're selling out these 2,000 seat buildings that are getting great atmosphere, you know, like, or whatever, or even selling out Arena Mexico with even better atmosphere. But the, you know, it's like the most important thing for them negotiating their deals are these numbers and these comparisons. And now, like, I mean, again, like, I don't know that they're even going to get comparisons. Like, is WWE going to know where they place? Maybe they may, and Tony may. But it's not as easy, and it's changing things, you know? I mean, so we'll see. But yeah, they're much harder to get now. And starting
I'll tell
this
you what, HBO Max gets like an extra 20 minutes of time for me because my normal Hulu feed always cuts off the AEW show, and I got to go find the last 20 minutes on HBO Max.
Yeah, that, you know, that shouldn't happen either.
I know. When I saw the runtime for the Wednesday show at 2 hours, 30 minutes, I was like, there's no way. And then I looked.
Oh, I knew
20 some odd minutes.
I knew he wasn't getting eight main event level matches in 2.5 hours. And I mean, he did that show with no backstage, very few interviews. I mean, rushing from thing to thing. The only thing that he didn't cut down on time was like the Adam Copeland and Mystico and Jericho ring entrances. He gave them, you know what I mean? He gave them their due because I think he knew that was like going to be the things that people talked about the most on the show. But yeah, you know, I mean, you know, everybody got their 11 minutes, you know, which was, you know, and Will and Davis and of course, Kyle Fletcher and Bailey got a lot more because they should have got a lot more, and they got their complete match, and both were awesome. And, you know, everybody else got enough time to have a very good match and not feel gypped. And yeah, and he still went 20 minutes. What was it? 2 hours and 52 minutes, I think, was the show.
Yeah, 52, 53, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't realize it was that long watching. And then I watched, I went back when I was writing my story and go, how long was this show exactly? And so I went back on my recorder and, you know, luckily my recorder went 3 hours. You know, I made sure to record for 3 hours because I knew he wasn't getting the thing done in 2 hours and 30 minutes.
I hit that 2 hour wall and the last 53 minutes of that show, I was worn down by then. I don't know. It's like, for me in wrestling, I think it's like that 2 hours and 15 minutes is like, okay, I'm good on a Wednesday night. Anything longer, I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on here?
It was a great show though. I mean, I mean, a lot of weeks I would have complained about it, but I can't complain because I can't say he went long on anything. I'd have dropped the Statlander match, honestly, but you know, he had angle reasons for doing it, so I know why he didn't. But everything else, I mean, I thought he did a good job. He got, like, you know, Mystico and Jericho and Darby Allin as a trio, I thought was a great, unique idea.
That was a very fun match.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they should.
Did you think of the history with those three guys in the ring together?
Well, it's just so unique. You know, it's three, like, you know, yeah, yeah. And Jericho doing the Corazon de Leon, you know, was really cool for me because I actually saw him as Corazon de Leon and he's wearing the same trunks. And
you better not tell him that story. You're going to make him feel old.
Oh, my God. That story. Hey, well, how do you think I felt? It's like, God, don't you know this is? You can see him every week. We have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah, because he's like 20 years old in that photo.
He's 23 years old or 20. Yeah, like 20, 22, 23 years old in that photo. And yeah, my kids only know Chris Jericho as the Huey Lewis. You know what I mean?
All right, let's end this with what's the update on Arena Mexico?
Oh, they got the Grand Prix tonight, so it's another big show, and it's usually one of their best matches of the year. It's a 22-man elimination match that will probably go an hour. So if you're not a fan of hour matches, this is not the night for you. Last year's went like 90 minutes, and I thought it was the best match of the whole year at Arena Mexico, and some people just thought it went too long. And I remember, like, before, because I had actually heard from people, oh my God, it was too long, it was terrible, blah, blah, blah. And I was almost going to, well, the last thing I need to do is watch a bad 90-minute match. And there were actually thank you readers that told me when I said that, you must watch this match and form your own opinion, because in fact I did. And the thing that was most notable to me was that crowd was never quiet. I mean, it's like, if you go in there and tell me that you're going to go with that tourist crowd and do a 90-minute match and people explain why it's not going to work, I am going to believe them. But sometimes, you know, there are lessons in wrestling where you know wrestling, and this happens actually all the time, and then you realize that crowds are different, things have changed, and maybe the rules from 10 years ago are not the rules of today, and you can't keep those rules of 10 years ago, because once you do, you're out of touch. And that was a big one for me, was that Grand Prix, because they went crazy for 90 minutes straight. That tourist, you know, and it's not just a tourist crowd. Three quarters of that crowd is hardcore wrestling fans. But it wasn't like they were dying out there by going long. I mean, you would think that your attention span and all that, but it was a so exciting match. And yes, it was redundant when you have, in that last year, you have 20 high flyers, or almost all high flyers. Some of them weren't, but most of them were, doing acai moonsaults all over the place. You would think that after a while, you know, like that type of a match is not your match to go 40 minutes, right? That's your match to go 15. But whatever it was on that night, that was awesome. And tonight, I mean, it's, you know, not everyone, Yujiro's in it, right? So it's like, not everyone's great. Boy, there's enough great guys in this one. I mean, no Mike Bailey, though, because like Mike Bailey was like the big star last year in this one. And you know, he was just there. You know, he just had like an incredible match on Wednesday night. It's like, God, Mike Bailey was the star last year. He's not in it this year. I would have loved to have seen him in it, but, you know, it's, you know, it'll be interesting, you know, like who, you know, who gets limited by who, how long Mystico lasts, how long Bandido lasts. Maybe Bandido gets, you know, Bandido's on the bad guy side, you know, because it's CMLL versus outsiders, and Bandido's on the lead star. Bandido and Claudio are like the lead stars of the other team. And you got Pac, you know, in a situation where, you know, like obviously the guy's a super wrestler, you know, but he doesn't always get to show it. And he's in the position where it's the night to show it. And Blake Christian, I mean, never in such a freaking high profile match. He's awesome, but he's, you know, he's the bland commander, you know, commander's not in it, by the way. After killing it every night, that poor guy, man, but Blake Christian and Lee Johnson on Tuesday night, when they did that tag match against the Calaveras, man, those guys they're a great team. They have no credibility because they don't win big matches on AEW TV, but they're like a great undercard team. And, you know, like Lee's not in, but Blake is, but yeah, just loaded, you know, with Dorada and Titan and Templario. I mean, you got all these awesome, awesome workers. So that's like, again, tonight, one of the bigger matches of the year. And then they got, they got pretty good lineups. I mean, they got Bandido in town and Clone for the weekend, and, pretty strong lineups for, Saturday, I think is like going to sell out way in advance. The last word I heard, and, is that tonight is not sold out still, which is interesting. But you know, like, you know what I mean? It's like, it's hard. They sold out Friday for a pay-per-view. They did, Mystico Return did 12,000 plus on a Sunday, which is way above normal. Then they did that pay-per-view on Tuesday that did 10,000. Then they did the Grand Slam that did a sellout. It's like, can you get so many people back on, and draw like, you know, whatever the sellout is for 13,200 or 16,000, whatever number you want to use, again on this Friday, even with that big match? It's asking a lot. They're I look at this and say that they're burning their audience out, but, and they probably are, but you know, until it happens, it's really one of the most amazing runs. This period will be looked back on in 20 years. And I, you know, like I will tell you, maybe not in the US, but in Mexico, this period will be looked back in 20 years and they're going to go like, oh my God, you know, it's like, what a boom period this was. 2025 and 2026, Arena Mexico, that place was hopping every Friday night. And You know, it's like, again, man, it's hopping outside the building as much as inside the building. It is a real, it's a real something, you know, it's like something I've never seen before. It's a combination of so many of the best factors of wrestling from the territory days and, you know, the super entertaining great workers of today and the variety of hitting the casual fan and hitting the hardcore fan, you know, even though some hardcore fans resent the changes, the merchandise, you know, that merchandise business in front of the building is it's unbelievable to see that, you know, it's just like, that's as entertaining almost as the show. But yeah, Saturday, I know that they had a really big advance, and then, so they had a big weekend, coming up too.
Okay. When are you and Brian coming back?
Sunday night.
All right. That is when you can check back in Sunday night. And that is all from here. So for Dave, I am Garrett. To everybody, thanks for watching and listening.